Real quick, I just want to clear up something. As always at the breaks, y'all ask the best questions. Y'all talk about one of the things that I always strike some nerves because I know there's some people in here that are taking medication, sleep medication or antidepressants. And I'm not one of those AA buckaroos that says that there's no room for any kind of medication, because that's nuts, because some of us need medication to get through the day. But there's some real big misunderstandings about it. And if any of you guys that want to stop and visit, I see it every day in the treatment center industry where I work. It's like we were talking about the other night. If 227 million prescriptions of antidepressants in the world, I mean, geez, we got a lot of people trying to medicate, just waking up not feeling good. Y'all follow? There's depression and then there's depression. Y'all follow? And a lot of people are taking pills to medicate what ordinarily could be medicated by this internal condition. Can also be treated, you know, you're having trouble sleeping. You might want to look at the amount of caffeine you're putting in your body. And as we get older, you know, we have a less and less likely to sleep. Maybe melatonin would be necessary. But, I mean, it always seems to be a pill to fix the problem. If I'm depressed, let me ask you a question. How much exercise are you getting? Oh, I run all day long. Horse shit. No, when you get up and go, actually go run, that's one thing. But just doing work around the house is not work. It's not exercise. Y'all follow what I'm saying? When's the last time you got out and actually walked up and down this beach at a pretty fast clip and got your heart up? I mean, guys, we're not sedentary people. And a lot of this is we don't exercise, we drink too much caffeine, we eat too much heavy food, and then we wonder why we feel kind of blah. And then the first thing we want to do, you follow? A lot of cats, it's like the guys that I sponsor, we end up having to go back through this work. Says, well, I'm on these medications. I says, why? Because I can't sleep. And I says, why can't you sleep? I says, well, I don't know. I lay down and all I can think about is how much money I owe. Oh? So let's start looking at our credit. Let's start looking at our money. I mean, that's part of what I do as a sponsor with the guys I sponsor, is I help them try to figure out financially where they're in. I watch a lot of people in the fellowship end up spinning themselves into happiness. How many of you guys ever went and bought something that you really didn't want? You did it because you thought it sounded like a good idea at the time. I'm living in an apartment in Houston, Texas with Myers one time, and we bought a sailboat. I'm talking about a big damn sailboat. Yes, we were drunk at the time. But why were we? It was the boat show. That's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to go buy a 32-foot sailboat. What? Why did we do that? Because for a minute, it felt great. A lot of you guys do that. That's the same thing. We eat too much. We get in bad relationships. We spend too much money, all trying to treat the spiritual malady. If we would just do the work, the spiritual malady would be treated. We would feel good again, and then we could get some real balance in our lives for the first time. Y'all follow? Somebody hit me up with a deal. Well, some of us need antidepressants. Yes, some of us do. Most of us don't. It's not the answer. A pill is very seldom the answer. Thanks.
Yeah.
Go get them. Yep. Oh, here's the little Crayola. Yep. And for those guys listening to tapes and CDs later on, the evil twin just sat down and the good twin just got up. Okay. It's interesting when you listen to these things, you'll have a hard time telling who's talking, because we sound a lot alike. And I know that you in the room can see the aura around me, and so you'll know that I'm the good one. Oh, shoot. I've already got the troublemakers picked out. I already know who they're going to be. I'm going to separate some of you in a minute, I can tell. The stuff that Chris was talking about just now, it's an interesting deal. In our literature, I don't know what it is in your book, in the French book, but in ours on page 17, they talk about something called the common solution. I want to read something real quick, and it will kind of launch us into what we're talking about and why we're talking about it. I'll read it out of this one, and then you can find it later. All the way down the page in our book, it says, "The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us." It is. You remember the first time you ever walked into an AA meeting? And you finally relaxed for just a minute and you kind of looked around the room. Your eyes finally got up off the table and you began to look around and you began to sense that you were in a room full of people that weren't judging you, that you could actually relax around. These were people just like you. These were little knucklehead fried pie guys that did the crazy crap you did, and you felt a unity with them. Well, this is good, and I'm not making light of any of that. But look at the book and the next line, what it says. "But that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined." Uh-oh. "The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution." So hold the thought for just a minute. The reason that we stay so fragmented in AA today is because we have ceased finding and seeking that common solution. What we've started doing is doing everything on our own, kind of freewheeling out there, and if it worked, it worked. And then we'll pass that information on. That's the reason why the meetings where we're just talking about a bunch of stuff get so bizarre sometimes. Yes, it maybe worked for you, but would it work for the brand new guy? That's the reason why they wrote the literature in the first place. That's the reason why they went through so much effort to put the thing together so that we could stay focused on the common solution. Andy read the foreword of the first edition, that first paragraph of the foreword of the first edition. We have Alcoholics Anonymous for more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we've recovered is the main purpose of this book, you see? And we've drifted clear of that. And what happened was is in that drifting sideways away from that common solution, we stopped being effective sponsors. Let me ask you guys a question. First, let me clarify something. I say you guys a lot. You guys means girls and guys too. It's like y'all in Texas. It means all of you. In Australia, some girl got so angry with me because she thought I was being discriminating against the women. It's so tedious to try to talk and go, now guys and gals, it just takes extra time to do that. And So I treat everybody in the same... I guess I could say you girls and we will ignore the guys and then it will be okay with me too. That's good, we'll do that. So you girls, remember... Ask yourself sometimes. This is a great example of what I'm talking about. I'm sponsoring some cats right now, brand new guys. It's funny how my sponsorship stuff has changed. I used to sponsor nothing but indigents, just guys off the street. These days I sponsor more and more business guys and guys that have chronic relapsers and men who have been in the program for many, many years. And they've gotten what we would call AA slick. They know the things to say. They know the things to do. They have become icons in their groups wherever they're going. But they don't really understand why it is that the internal condition, which is alcoholism, is kicking their butts. Why is it I get up every morning obsessing about a woman I haven't got? Why is it I get up every morning unhappy that I don't have enough money, that I'm not... You see what I'm saying? It's just this crazy malaise that we find ourselves into. So... It's one of those kind of things where if we, in this collection of men that I'm working with right now, I have five guys who have a combined sobriety of well over 100 years. These guys are almost 20 plus. One of them's close to 30 years sober. Collectively, one night we were all sitting in a little room, and collectively, these five men, I said, how many men have you guys sponsored? And collectively, they had sponsored five guys. Which meant one guy had sponsored two, one guy hadn't sponsored any in almost 20 years. And what, you see what I'm saying? We have sold ourselves on this idea that sponsorship is this absolute beating, that it's just this nasty ordeal that we got to go through. And if I can, it's so painful for me as a sponsor, and I'm so uncertain about what to do that I'll just hold it at a distance. And so I'm in a meeting and I share something and I'm watching this little guy and he's looking at me and I'm going, oh no, oh no. He's going to ask me to sponsor him. And so I do whatever I can do to get clear. Some of you spiritual giants wouldn't do that. But I'm telling you, if you do it and will admit it, I empathize with you because I did it for years. I love you. I want you here. I just don't want to have anything to do with you, really. I'm just here to share. Okay? Because sponsorship, frankly, scares the spit out of me because I am uncertain about my own truth. And that's the reason why we spent so much time this morning talking about step one truths. If I am uncertain why I drink, then I will be ambivalent about sponsorship and about carrying that message to somebody else. It's like trying to teach somebody how to paint when you don't know how to paint. What the hell are you doing? I mean, you see, I haven't had the experience as a recovered alcoholic, but I'm going to try to teach you how to become a recovered alcoholic. I haven't actually had sex, but I'm going to teach you about having sex. Can you imagine how uncomfortable that would be, trying to teach somebody about something they've never experienced? You see, and that's the reason why I think that we've gotten in so much trouble in AA land out there worldwide, is that we have tens of thousands of people sitting in meetings sharing about experiences that they have not had. And it's tolerable with the younger guys, but when you get guys like me sitting in meetings doing it, it's really sad. It's really sad. And the only thing that it takes to get back on track is just some courage, just some willingness to lay there in the bunk at the end of the day and look at the ceiling and go, do I really understand my disease? Do I really understand how to get a guy from point A to point B? And if you do, super. I'll give you another fast example. We were in a meeting one night in a deal much like this, and I said, how many of you guys feel comfortable and understand how to carry a man through the work? And everybody raised their hand. There wasn't one person in the room that didn't raise their hand. And over the weekend, between breaks, I was talking to these guys, and it became real obvious. You know what? None of you guys know how to carry anybody through the work. There wasn't one guy that I talked to that had a clear picture of what to do. And so we had to kind of break that down in the next little meeting session, which was fairly painful, and there's a little weeping going on. But it was okay. We got through the deal. But the cool part about it is that once you make that realization, once you go, I may not be clear about what to do, then you can begin to piece together the things that you need to understand. The reason sponsorship is tough going is because I make it tough going, because I've added all kinds of things in here. I think I have to be your best friend. I don't. I don't even have to like you. Guys, I sponsor guys now that I can't stand. I swear to God, I don't even want to be in the same room with them. But I'll love them enough to show them what I did to recover. I'll show them what needs to be done. But this idea that I've got to take on the responsibility of all their financial woes, all their spiritual woes, all their relationship problems, there's nowhere in this literature that said that. It's no wonder that we get so scared about the idea of sponsorship. And so what this is an idea. And if you're doing that, fine. If I'm sponsoring one man, I can take a lot of his responsibility. I can shoulder a lot. But let me ask you this question, just for an observation. What if you're sponsoring 30 men? Then what do you do? You see? And people say that all the time. You can't do that. Sure you can. I've been doing it for years. Sure you can. And most of the guys that I sponsor are doing that. You bet you can. And that's the kind of stuff that we're talking about. We're trying to kind of gently dust off the stuff that's cluttering everything up and making this thing complicated, and getting it so that it's a little easier to do, so that you can run through this process a little quicker. Something that Chris said earlier that I want to make sure that we clarify, I have no right in any form or fashion to ever label you an alcoholic or a non-alcoholic. That is not my job to label you one way or the other. It is my job, however, to help you see your truth around your alcoholism. Because if you're not sure, if you're ambivalent about any part of that, if you're questioning your own sobriety or your own alcoholism, then it will manifest itself later. It'll come out later down the road. And you'll see a lot of that. And that's the reason why in the beginning we spend so much time. That's the reason why Bill Wilson in the first of the book, when they wrote this thing, that's the reason why they spent so much time talking about this mental component that was at the bottom of this thing. The doctor's opinion in the front of the book addresses what? Primarily the physical allergy, the physical part of alcoholism. Everything else from the doctor's opinion all the way up through page 44, there's a whole big old slug of book in there. Fred's story, Jim's story, the Jaywalker story, all of these stories are there for what? Trying to get you to get your arms around this idea of a mental obsession. The mental component. This is the stuff that separates me from the goofy hard drinker that sat on that same bar stool out there that could quit or moderate. We all have guys, hard drinkers in our families. We all see guys like that. Oh, I had an Uncle Joe one time, and he just one day just stopped. See, nobody wants to ask whether Uncle Joe was a real alcoholic or not, you see. And what we're trying to do in this initial meeting, Andy, where did Andy go? Andy's my brand new drunk. He just came in. For the taping record, he's not. He's been sober a long time. But Andy, Andy's my brand new guy, and he comes in, and we're going to spend some time initially talking about this thing. We're going to try to figure out if he can. What do they talk about in chapter 7, working with others? They spend most of the first part of this stuff giving you illustrations of how they 12-stepped each other. And one of the primary things that they did was not try to beat him up and drag him into AA. They tried to do what Bob did, what Bill did to Dr. Bob. They tried to sell him on the idea of alcoholism. Bob's a spiritual giant. Bill came in, this little busted up guy, came in and for the very first time sold Bob on the idea of the hopelessness and the chronic nature of his alcoholism. And from that moment, Bob goes, holy cow, this is not fun. This is going to kill me. You see, I suffer under the illusion that at some point, at any point in there, it'll get bad enough and I'll just say, I'm not going to do this anymore. Or I'm going to adjust some external circumstances. I'm a drunk because she's here. I'll get rid of that cow and I'll be okay. You see, it's crazy. There it is. Once again, we've slipped over here and we're treating alcoholism as if it's a behavior problem. I'll modify behavior. If alcoholism was a behavior problem, treatment centers would be turning out 100% recovered alcoholics every day by the thousands. We're just going to modify your behavior. We're going to find out what it was that made you drink the way that you drank. And yet it's not. Alcoholism, it's just not behavioral. There may be behavior stuff that exacerbates and causes problems within the confines of the alcoholism. But when we strip everything else away, I have a body that simply will not handle alcohol the right way. My pancreas and liver, the way it processes alcohol, is different than the normal drinker. And now, combined with that, I have a mental component of this thing that's destined to kill me, because my mind will always tell me that a drink will fix it. Always. I don't care how bad my drama got. I don't care what happened. I don't care what circumstances it was at the lowest that I ever was as a drunk. Give me a little bit of time to think about it, a few moments sometimes. And my head takes me back to a time on the Guadalupe River when I was 17 years old in Texas, and I got a quart of beer right here and a little girl right here, and the moon's coming up through those cypress trees, and I can feel the breeze in my face, and it is perfect. Perfect. My head, the mental part of this, always takes me back to that time. And I'm destined, from that perspective, I'm destined to always drink again. Because it worked then, it solved every problem I had then. But see, a normal person doesn't do that. Did you ever wonder, when you're reading all these examples in the big book, Fred's story and Jim's story, and the jaywalker especially, did you ever look at those stories and go, why are these are the stupidest stories in the world. Why would these be in there? I never connected the dots. I never could understand why he spent so much time. I just skipped over him. I just go, we don't need that crap, and we'll get into something else. I didn't understand. What they were trying to do is get me to understand that how different I am from the non-alcoholic. This is the very thing that separates me from the heavy drinker, the little disco drunk that just got in trouble, maybe left a bar one night, got a DWI, and the judge says, you got to go to AA, and so he comes to AA. And so everybody in the room, it's all hands off. Welcome, welcome, I'm glad you're here. And we are. There's nothing wrong with that. But then everybody stays clear of him, and nobody wants to help him see what his truth is. This little guy may not be an alcoholic. He may not be. And the reality of that is that it's our job as real deal alcoholics to help him see his truth. Not so we can kick him out of AA. Please don't go there. Please don't. Not so that we can be exclusionary and elite here. Don't do that. We're trying to help this guy understand. If he understands on a gut level that alcoholism is chronic in nature and he's going to die of this deadly disease, then all of the lurking notions that I can drink like normal men and women will go away. That discomfort, there's an article down here that talks about this. That discomfort is the greatest thing in the world. In AA, we immediately muddy the water because we say, if you forget your last drink, you haven't had it. That's crap, guys. I forgot my last drink. I'm telling you, and you will too. I can't even remember. We sit in meetings and we talk about these war stories. I can't even remember my own war stories, much less your war story. It's just we try to keep each other scared about the story. I need to remember what it was like so I can pass that on to somebody else when I'm talking to them. But the real crux of what I need to know and remember and keep dear to my heart is the chronic nature of alcoholism. And from that point of discomfort, I will gladly embrace anything you ask me to do. I will be willing to do whatever you want me to do. It's funny how we trivialize this stuff. If Andy came up to me after this meeting and said, "Myers, I've got some bad news. I've got some cancer, and I think I'm real sick," we would feel sorry for him. And I'd say, "Andy, what are you going to do?" And he said, "Well, they have a clinic. They have a clinic in Paris, and Monday morning I'm going to be there and we're going to start treatment." No kidding. Yep, that's what we're going to do. Now see, this is how we treat something that we take seriously. But it's a funny thing. In alcoholism, which is as deadly and kills as many people as cancer does, we just simply trivialize it. We just kind of like make... I say, "Andy, don't you think you better get busy with these steps and we'll get on into this stuff?" "Oh, well, I have plenty of time. A man in the meeting the other night said I need to feel comfortable in AA before I start any of the steps. So I figure in a year we'll start. Maybe a couple of months down the road we'll start." Yeah. Immediately what we've done is we've trivialized our disease. We've just said it's good. But guess what? On page 24 in our literature, in our book, they talk about this thing we won't be able to bring into consciousness with sufficient force, the pain and suffering of even a week or a month ago. Bill was clear on this in the beginning of this deal, that we won't be able to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force what it was like, what happened. We think we will. Oh, I'll know when I... How many guys that are sponsoring guys have heard this? I'll know when I get sick enough. You hear this? "Oh, I'm okay. I'm fine. I know I haven't been to a meeting in 6 months, but I'll know. I'll know if I get sick." No, you won't. No, you won't. Because here it is in fashion. The spiritual malady will begin to reassert itself and you will begin to feel separate and apart from everybody. You already feel separate from AA, don't you? Uh-huh. And then in short order, I'm going to feel separate from God. Uh-huh. And now I'm just out there freewheeling, trying to manhandle the day and make something happen. You see? And from that perspective, it's only a matter of time before the thought, "Wouldn't a quart of beer taste great?" comes in. And my own arrogance tells me it'll never happen. But my experience and the experience of thousands of drunks that have gone before me says it will happen. It will. You know, any of you guys ever been caught off guard and found yourself in that situation where all of a sudden you're almost ready to take a drink? It's a scary, scary place to be. Terrifying to realize how quickly you can slide back into that situation and how quick you can get sick again. Anyway. That's the reason why we do this stuff. We're not here insisting that you do the work the way we do the work. That's not why we're here. We're here hoping that as we talk about this work, that we can kind of follow back and get into a sort of a semblance of a line carrying a common solution, so that we can... The book says that our common solution would guarantee your recovery. It says it in dozens of places in the book. And so all we needed to do, and that was what I found after going to a primary purpose group at 7 years sober. Devastated by what alcoholism was doing to me again, although I hadn't taken a drink yet. But I get in with these guys and they say, "We have a common solution and we're going to talk about that one thing." "I know, but I need to share my day." "No, you don't. Not here." "Share it with your sponsor. Here, we're going to share a common solution." And it was tough, guys. I got to tell you, it was tough. When you're a guy like me who was used to sharing that kind of stuff, it was the hardest thing that I ever did, was to bite my tongue and not share that kind of stuff. But once I understood, and we're going to talk about that some this afternoon, once I understood that I could actually share hope in a meeting by sharing the common solution, that the solution that the literature gave us carried great, great weight and hope to the newcomer, then all of a sudden it wasn't me trying to carry some lame message, it was the big book and its power and the steps in its great power carrying this message of hope and recovery. Good stuff. Good. So let's pretend for the sake of this example here, let's pretend that what we have is Andy is coming to this meeting and we've pulled him off the one side after the meeting and we're sitting there just kind of talking a little bit. I tell him a little bit about my stuff. He tells me a little about his stuff and he goes, He's a slam dunk. He already knows that he's an alcoholic. He's not faltering under any illusions that he's anything else. He knows what he is, which is great. It makes it that much easier. And then finally he just says, you know, I think I'm just like you. I recognize in your story that you and I are a lot alike. And then he looks at me and he does just what the book describes. He says, Myers, tell me what you did. There it is. It's the hook. That's all I wanted him to say. That's all I wanted him to do is ask me what I did. And then I could tell him. I made a beginning, just like what you're doing, Andy. I had to come to grips with the fact that I've got a chronic disease that's going to kill me. Are we okay there? We're all on the same page. And Andy goes, I know I'm screwed. Terrific. And then we talk about this stuff. If lack of power, remember, the bugaboo here is not the booze. The bugaboo, the problem is that I cannot manage the decision to not take the drink. Guys, we're all good stoppers. We're just better starters, you see? It's just sort of the nature of that beast. And so there's what we're trying to do is that get him to understand that if he thinks he's going to be able to muster the willpower, we've got to squash that real quick. If this isn't about willpower, if it was about willpower, most of us would be in real trouble. This is not about willpower. This is about finding a power greater than ourselves that could get us to a place where we could get clear of this deal. And this is where the world gets kind of goofy on this thing. But Bill, it's funny how it all worked out. If we understood on a gut level that lack of power was our dilemma, that's what's going to kill us. We don't have the power to stay clear of the booze. If we understand that's the problem, then the solution is obvious. I got to find some power. And that's what the rest of this work was about. How to find the power that was enough, that was sufficient enough to get me clear of the booze. And we get sold all kinds of things which confuse the issue. Meeting makers make it. In AA worldwide, it always seems to go back to the meeting. If you want to survive, be in the meeting. If you want to do this, be in the meeting. If you want to be in the meeting. And you know what? In our literature, there's not one place ever where it says that the solution to your problem is in a meeting. Please don't misunderstand this. I don't want you calling your sponsor after this thing and saying, you know what that little bastard said? He said, don't go to a meeting. I didn't say that. I'm going to make it clear. I did not say that. But what I said is that if you're putting all your eggs in that basket, you may be in for a real surprise. Because there's a lot of us that die sitting in the meeting. There's a lot of us that get real sick sitting in the meeting. The meeting will not treat the internal condition, which is your alcoholism. The only thing that we know that will effectively do that are the steps. A connection to a higher power that we're going to come to know at some point in time in the deal. And that's why it's so important on the deal like that. It's like, if the meeting was the big deal, then don't you think Bill Wilson would have done step 13? Go to meetings. But he never said that. There are a lot of people that recover just by reading the big book, just by going through and following the clear-cut directions, got through the deal. You see, the meetings are important, guys. They certainly are. But sometimes we get hung up in that. And I think some of you guys already recognize that. Some of you will recognize that. If you don't, put it on a personal basis. Stop and think about what it was like when you first got to AA and you were so excited you were about to pee on yourself every time you went to a meeting. You just couldn't. It was the coolest thing in the world. I can't wait to get back in the meeting. Nothing wrong with that. But I want you to fast forward 2 years down the road, 3 years down the road, however long it took. And now all of a sudden the meeting seems tedious to me. And I'm making excuses why I can't go and why I don't want to go and it's just all of these things are happening because as a taker in AA, as this need to be fed by the meeting gets me downrange, what happens is that eventually the internal condition again is not being treated. It's not getting what it needs, and I get sick. You see, we're there as a novel thought. We're going to talk about it all today. We're there to give, not receive. I'm there in the meeting to give, not receive. And if you're going into the meeting waiting to be fed, you're in for a frustrating, frustrating time. Because in that thought process, guys, in that thought, there's a great deal of expectation. And when my expectations aren't met, I get goofy. I want to retaliate. I get mad. I weep. All these emotional things are attached to my expectations of what you're supposed to be feeding me in that meeting. It's a really sick place to be. But the moment, this is the thing that they taught me when I got over to that crazy primary purpose group and those guys. The moment I made the mental connection that I was there to give instead of receive, everything about my program shifted. All of a sudden, I'm enthused about learning about the book because this is what I have to teach. You see, I can't teach my guys that I sponsor if I don't understand it myself. And so I become, if you want to become a good, strong sponsor, learn the book. They go kind of hand in hand. I didn't really care about what was in the book until I was faced with the prospect of sponsoring a handful of guys. And then all of a sudden I'm going, oh, crap, now what? You see? Then I had to get busy. And you'll understand that stuff. I hear people in meetings all the time going, well, I'm working on step two. I'm working on step two. And 6 months later, well, I'm almost there to step two. I just want to slam my head down on the desk. There's nothing to work on. It's the simplest part of the whole deal. It doesn't make any difference if you have a formed idea of what God is like and you're all warm and fuzzy with it, or if you have no idea what it's like and you don't even really believe there's a God. You don't have to believe anything. And Bill, in his infinite wisdom, those guys that wrote the book, wrote a whole chapter called We Agnostics Working with Others, because they knew that at least 50% of us that came to this deal had God sideways in our crawl when we got here. We're not all little sunbeams for Jesus when we get here. We aren't. Some of us are. I'm telling you guys, there's a part of me that wanted to break God over my knee when I got here. I just didn't want anything to do with God. And the thought of it made me sick. But the thought of dying drunk made me sicker. The thought of dying an alcoholic death was horrifying to me. And so, all I did was follow the directions in the book of what they were talking about. Was I willing to believe that there was anything out there bigger than me that could restore me to sanity? The insanity that they're talking about is the mental component of this deal. It's the part that separates me from everybody that's normal out there. Is there anything out there greater than me? What put the stars up there? Do I need to know and understand? Do I need to label it? Do I need to put... No! I don't care if you think God looks like the Easter Bunny. I don't care! And nor should any of you, really. It's just simply not the deal. But the pathway to the power was understanding that there was something out there that was bigger. The mistake I think that we make is trying to sell somebody our idea of God. You see? And that's the reason why we make a lot of mistakes in our rooms, is that we want to share our religious conversion, and we share it just like that. And the brand new guy that's got God stuck sideways in his craw listens to that and goes, oh, let me ask you a question, guys. Just between me and you guys, did you ever sit in a Sunday school class when you were growing up, church school or something like this, and look around the room and wonder why you were the only one that wasn't getting it? I mean, I'm looking around at this little room full of, you know, little saints, and I'm just going, why can't I get it? You know, I'm sitting in the room, and all I want to do is dismember something. I'm just like, well, sitting here flicking a cigarette lighter into the seat, trying to light the seat on fire. I want desperately to be good. I want desperately to understand it the way you understand it. I just can't. It's like two extension cords that just aren't quite long enough. And everybody else snapped into it real easy. And I'm still sitting over there struggling, just trying to... Damn it! If I could just get it a little bit closer. If I could just hold my mouth just right. If I could just... You understand what that's like? You see? And there is the dilemma that we face. There is the dilemma. And depending on how you were raised or what you came through, it could be a real stumbling block. You know, you get brand new guys and you're looking at the steps, and he's reading them off the wall, or he's looking at them in his book, and he sees the God thing and he just goes, oh, fuck. You see? And what we're trying to get these little buckaroos to understand these days I would rather have you coming in hating God. I'd rather have you coming in with no idea of God than to come in a little sunbeam for Jesus. Because in that perspective, there's nothing wrong with that except that you come in with a bunch of preconceived ideas. You come in with a bunch of other people's ideas of what it is that you're dealing with. And what I'd rather you to do is experience, hear what it's like to get plugged in. As you begin to do the work, as you begin to do the things that we do, even though you don't really believe it's going to happen, one day you pull on the extension cord and you notice that they're coming a little closer together. And you go, damn, this is pretty cool. It actually, you know, it's not such a struggle. You see? And you do a little more work and you get a little service commitment and you do the other things and pretty soon you go, shit, I'm almost there. And pretty soon, you're there. And without even knowing it, for most of us, it was an absolute left field surprise. We just wake up one morning and we sit on the edge of our bed and we go, shit, I'm okay. I'm okay. I'm happy. You see? The little extension cord locks together and you just lay it down. And there's no more struggle. There's no more fighting. There's no more intensity in trying to be what you can't be. It was just all done for you because you were willing to do one thing. Submit to a program of action which required just that. Action. You were going to do something. In order to be a parent, you have to do something. You can't just be a parent by sitting in a PTA meeting. You see what I'm saying? You got to actually do something. You know, you have to... We go from spiritual into the toilet just like that. I mean, nobody but a Texan could screw that up. You see? But that's what this thing is about. And so in this step two thing, we're not going to make a big deal out of it. And most of the step two work that I do with guys that I'm sponsoring like this, we're in it and out of it in 5 minutes. Tell me what you think about God. And he'll go, I love God. Okay, next. Or he'll say, I hate God. I say, okay, next. I just need to know where he is. You see what I'm saying? This is not a big, long, drawn-out ordeal. They didn't spend a lot of time in it. Look at the way it is in the big book. They didn't do that. Did you have something you wanted to add?
Always.
You wait just a minute. You can do that. I can always tell when Chris is getting pensive back there. He either needs to go to the bathroom or he's being pensive about wanting to say something. So
my butt's hurt.
So... which would bring us to step three, and we're in really good shape time-wise on this thing. This is where the fun of this whole thing begins. You've got a brand new guy. Andy and I have only been talking for 20 minutes in the back room, okay? This is not a protracted deal. For 20 minutes, we've been back there. In 20 minutes, I know what Andy is. Andy knows what his truth is. I know where he is around the idea of God and a higher power. I understand that deal. And then we get into this deal. It's a funny thing in the book. You ever notice the way it sets itself up? It's on page 62 where it starts in our book. 61, it won't be in your book. But there's after the ABCs, you know where those are? They'll have those in your the French book, I think it's in there. There's the ABCs on there. And then it says, being convinced we were at step three. And then they go two pages talking about something that is the most bizarre thing in the world, selfishness and self-centeredness. If you guys were like me, I always wondered why Bill did this. Wait a minute. Booze and drugs, that's the root of my problem. Why is it we're talking about selfishness and self-centeredness? Fortunately, they didn't ask me to write the book. And in his wisdom, he understood what the lowdown was. There's a world of goofiness that stands between me and recovery, and one of the first ones that we need to address is selfishness and self-centeredness. I know you guys aren't selfish in any form or fashion. Nor was I for many, many years. But buddy, when I saw it, when I realized it, as we slide from three into four, we began to get our noses rubbed into just how selfish and self-centered that we are and how full of fear that we are and all the wreckage that we've caused based on self. And that's what we're going to talk about after lunch. You guys will be really tired, so we're going to do this thing after lunch naked so that, yeah, everybody's got to take their clothes off to come in. And all of y'all do too, see? And so that way we can stay awake. We'll be too busy gawking at each other to get sleepy. So what there's talking, we're not, honest. Y'all have 10 of you coming up. Do we really have to do this? No, you don't. You don't want to see me naked after you eat anyway. It's just like, God dang. I'm going to read a couple of things on here. and try to clear a little piece of this up before we get into it. And Chris can tie this up before lunch. The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, we are almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Now, this is the first place where Bill and Bob and those guys are trying to tell us that something may be amiss, that we may be doing something we shouldn't be doing. So let me ask you this quick question. How many of you guys think that all your drama, maybe you don't think that way now, but I bet you did at one time, thought that all of your drama came about from your booze and your drugs? My illusion is that if I stop drinking, if I stop doing those nasty drugs, everything will get better. My life will get immediately better, because that's always been my problem, if I could just stop drinking. I never dreamed that there was anything else out there on the horizon that was tripping me up. And there is. There is. And then he gives you a couple of examples of what it's like. He says, what usually happens? The show doesn't come off very well. He begins to think life doesn't treat him right. He decides to exert himself more. He becomes, on the next occasion, still more demanding or gracious, as the case may be. Men, we see this all the time in relationships. It's the easiest place to see your own selfishness. It's the easiest place. Guys, can't you be kind to a woman? That's the response is like this. Yes, you can be kind to a woman. Can you be mean? All the women are going, yeah, sure they can. But can't we do what we got to do to get what we want, to get from point A to point B, you see? But we don't ever really understand why we're doing all that stuff. Selfishness and self-centeredness is playing a big role in this thing. But we're varied about this thing. We're not. Most of us don't come in here as jerks, but we can be variations of jerks. We can be. There's all kinds of stuff at play. There's a line here that says, is he not really a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? I'll wash the dishes. I'll mop. I'll do the laundry. I will. And then you can, you know, help out. I mean, even when trying to be kind, but my motives are always what they're. At the bottom line, my motives are always one thing. Myers wants what he wants when he wants it. And to the extent that that dominates your life, it's to the extent that the drama explodes in your life. The more I insist that you do things my way, the more conflict we're going to have. You ever talk to somebody like that in a meeting? That they just will not converse without beating you up, because you have to see it their way. You see? To the extent that. Any of you guys ever meet a girl in a bar and tell her you were a doctor? Y'all didn't do that? You guys are saints. We ought to go home, man. I'm telling you like that. I'd tell you whatever I think you wanted to hear. Yeah, I'm rich. Oil well, yeah, I got one of them too. See? But I want what I want. Listen to the definition of selfishness. This is pretty funny, like this. Concerned excessively or exclusively with oneself, seeking or concentrating on one's own advantage, purpose, or well-being, and here's the important part, without regards for others. See, it's not that I'm a mean guy. It's just that I don't even know you exist. I go through life running my game, totally unaware that you're even there. You see? And there's where we get into this. And we wonder why people just can't stand to be around us. The unfortunate part is that for so many of us, we get well off into our sobriety, well off into this work, and never see that truth, because we didn't do adequate fourth and fifth steps. We didn't do appropriate work there. And what we ended up doing was just passing on through that thing and carrying the selfishness and self-centeredness to the other part of our existence. On 62, there's a line in here that says, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Guys, it's such a conflict. It's such a contradiction to what I feel. Booze and drugs, that I think is the root of my problem. And I'll take it to my death. Because I don't want to look at the other part of this thing. I'm a giving and loving guy. Sensitive sometimes, yes, but I'm a giving guy. And I don't want anybody to squelch that story. Because that's the illusion, that's the delusion that I've lived with for years and years and years. I'm the kindest man I know. I don't think about the night I pushed you around. I don't think about the night I laid there in bed and heavy sighed until you finally said, oh, for crying out loud. I don't care that you worked 14 hours today and you're dead dog tired on your feet. I don't give a rat's butt. I don't care. All I want you to do is fix this. You see? Demonstrative? Yes. You guys aren't like that, I know. But if you ask me if I'm like that, I'll tell you no. I'm not like that. I'm loving, and I'm the most thoughtful husband in the world. You see? And until I get my nose rubbed into it in inventory, and I look at why you retaliated, I've got this mean old beast of a woman that I'm married to, and she does all these things. Why does she do them? Doesn't she see the loving kindness in me? No. She sees the tyrant that insists that she does things she doesn't want to do right now. She sees that. And she retaliates. And then I retaliate. But all I see is my deal. I don't see her deal at all. Until somebody makes me see it in the inventory. And that's the reason why it's so important. And that's the reason why it's so important that we do it immediately. That we get on down the road and see this thing. You see? It says, so our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourself, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. This God that I don't even really believe in, that I don't really have a clue what he is or she is, I don't know anything about that. All I know is that this literature keeps telling me that if I'll simply submit to the process, that I'll get what happens every time. And I've never seen it fail in all these years. Not ever have I seen it fail if you'll submit to that stuff. And then they talk about freedom at the bottom of the page. And then they give us this prayer, and then I'll let Chris finish this stuff up. The third step prayer that's on 63 in our literature, it's an interesting piece of literature. Nowhere in the prayer does it say anything about relieve me of the bondage of booze and alcohol, or booze and drugs, or booze. Relieve me of the bondage of sex. Relieve me of the bondage of gambling. Relieve me of the bondage of overeating. It doesn't say it. What does it say in the middle of this prayer? Relieve me of the bondage of self. There it is. This is the biggest single area where I think that we need to take what we think we know about AA and set it on the floor and re-examine it. Look at it again and see if we can't pick up what they're really saying here. What they're really saying here is that, and this is what my own experience has bore out, when I get up in the mornings, booze isn't waiting for me. I'm not fearful of the booze. What's waiting for me is self. And self, relieve me of the bondage of self, because they understood that coming from a position of self, I'm always going to be in a collision course with you. Always. Going to be in collision course. My fears spring from self. My sex stuff, my need for things spring from self. We'll talk about this stuff a little bit after lunch during the inventory about the fears and stuff, but because it's a big, big piece of this deal. But at its core, always is self. And it's funny thing. It's like somebody telling you a joke you didn't get, and then you hear it later and you still don't get it. But at some point in time, you connect the dot about self and what it's done to you. And you go, and I've seen this in hundreds of men over the years. They go, oh, shit. I see it. Yeah, I know you do. You see, I went from being a victim where everybody in the world got over on me to being a willing participant in the drama of my life and the cause of most of my problems. And then I have a choice to make. I got to deal with it. And the inventory that we're getting ready to do is what helps us see that stuff. Good shit. Good shit. You want to finish this through lunch? You got about 22 minutes.
Won't even need that.
Chris Rammer, recovered alcoholic. I am the good twin.
Affirmation. Just keep saying it.
I know. I am the good twin. I am the good twin. I am. Knowing about God and knowing God are two different things. Would y'all agree? and I know that there's a lot of people, what Myers was alluding to earlier, what he was talking about, is a lot of us bring so much preconceived information into this fellowship about what this God thing is. And the truth is, Bill Wilson, again, in his infinite wisdom, and Frank Parkhurst, and the first cats that helped write this book, they all understood that if we had to make my God the same as your God, and you had to be that way, we were going to kill inadvertently a whole lot of people. So this is as open and roomy as it can possibly be. That's why it drives me crazy when we come in here and we want to spend way too much time talking about this. If I had been setting this up, we wouldn't be talking this much about it. It's like, it's real simple. Nowhere in the book does it say you've got to have a preconceived idea of this and have it all figured out. Everybody wants to do that in treatment. I don't understand God. Me neither. Okay, move on. Let's go. I'm 20 years sober. I mean, I still don't understand God. I mean, thank God. I don't know. I think I know a little bit more about that thing called the spirit of the universe and the creator. My ideas have crystallized, and I feel comfortable about certain areas today more than I did when I first got here 20 years ago. But all you got to do is have this idea that there's something out there bigger than you to make a beginning. And it's like when somebody comes into these rooms, guys, y'all realize that we have one thing to sell here. We're like a shoe salesman with one pair of shoes. This is what we're selling. Do you have any handbags? Nope, don't. How about belts? Nope. We laugh, but that's what we do. We come in here like this. You can have anything you want. Pick what you want and leave the rest. I'm sorry. One stinking pair of shoes, that's all we got. You want them? It's a yes or no. Well, yes. I think I'll try those. No? Then go away. This idea that we have something else to sell besides this thing called the spiritual experience is ludicrous. You can have anything you want, any way you want it. But this is where people get up and leave. They talk too much about God. They talk too much about God. All we have to sell here is God. I can't rid myself of the selfish and self-centeredness that Myers is talking about. I got to have the spiritual experience, which allows me to wake up in the morning and not think about me and think about you. It's a pretty cool deal. I didn't get on the plane to come over here to hear myself talk. I got on the plane to come over here and visit with you and get to know y'all. Out of my head, I can be of use to you guys. Y'all follow? Not once in 20 years have I wanted to pick up a drink. That's the miracle of it. For 19 years, I drank and could not drink for periods of time. But when I wasn't drinking, there's a great line in the book. Bill Wilson says, it's over in the more about alcoholism, I think it says, it's the great obsession of every abnormal drinker to be able to control and enjoy his drinking. This is a great line, because I can control it. You piss me off, that I'll stop. That's what you want. I'll quit right now. Make you happy. I'll quit. And I'm going to make you miserable. My first wife used to bring a bottle of vodka home and said, set it down and say, here, drink this. Honey, I'm sober 3 weeks now. You don't want to ruin my relapse. You don't want me to relapse, do you? She says, you're not sober. You're dry maybe, but you're not sober. I liked you better drunk. So you're nodding your head. Yeah. Okay, honey, if you insist. I mean, I don't know. I mean, this is not what I want. I'm off to the stupid right. We only have one thing. Guy comes into the deal and says, I'll do this program, but I don't do this God thing. Then I can't help you. I'm not saying you have to leave. I'm not saying you're not welcome. I can't help you because I'm not here as a part of a self-help program. The steps don't get me sober. Are y'all keen on that? The steps don't fix me. The steps allow me to have a thing called a spiritual experience, and God fixes me. This is what everybody wants to split hairs with. The steps got me sober. No, they didn't. The steps clearing out all the gunk so that you could have this thing called a spiritual experience, and this power that created that beautiful sea out there got me sober. And if somebody in their arrogance wants to come in here and argue with me whether there's a God or not, I'm not going to waste 10 seconds. That's what I'm saying. Over half of us believed that there was a God when we got here. Why even read this? The worst meetings I go to are the meetings where we read these chapters, because it just seems so redundant. Why are we talking about something that I don't have a problem in the world with? I always knew. When I was eating out of dumpsters in Houston, Texas, I knew there was something out there bigger than me. Never had a problem. You'll follow? Didn't have any access, didn't have any knowledge, that's the deal. This is not about belief in God. This is about access to this power. And that's what the 12 steps do. Y'all cool with that? Real quick, and I'm going to move. this whole thing revolves around a thing called a little window of opportunity. Bill Wilson wrote extensively about it. Of course, when the treatment center's gotten involved in it, they called it the pink cloud. Y'all ever come into a meeting and all of a sudden you start to do a little work and you start feeling better and you everything just seems okay. And it's like, I don't know what happens. Last week I was ready to commit suicide, and this week, buddy, I see some hope. I see some things happening. And some old geezer over in the corner will kick somebody in the side and, said, well, watch him. He's on that pink cloud. And when he falls off, he's going to bust his ass. And, and it's just, ha, ha, ha. They make fun of us when we catch fire with this thing. And I got to tell you something, folks. There's people out there right now for 20 years waiting for me to hit, to fall off that pink cloud. That feeling of neutrality around the alcohol and that hopefulness is what we call God's grace. That's what Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob wrote extensively about. This is a real thing. This is cause and effect. There's no stepchildren here. There's no, some of us are going to get it, some of us are not. It's cause and effect. You do the work, even in a bumbling way. You get off your butt and begin to pursue this rather quickly. Some of you at the third step prayer, some of you at fourth step. Mine was between the fourth and fifth step when I had my spiritual experience. And it only intensified as I finished doing the work. First time I started sponsoring somebody, I cried for a week, because I realized how the whole thing worked. I help you over here. Guess who's helping me over here? And that's what we talk about later this afternoon. God's helping me over there. I mean, this is real. We're going to walk around and tiptoe, and we're not going to talk about God because we don't want to embarrass anybody and we don't want to offend anybody. Listen, I was talking over in Louisiana not long ago about it, and from the time I got there, they warned me about the guy. And the guy was sitting back over here, and he was the atheist of the group. And he didn't talk about God. And any meeting he was in, and they started talking about God, he got up and left. And I fixed it real quick. We started off talking about God. You follow? And he got up and left. And you think I give a rat's butt? Now, how many people, that's what Myers has said, how many people have we killed tiptoeing around this thing about God? I don't want to make you uncomfortable. I just want to paint a clear picture that this is open and roomy. Guys, when I got to this fellowship, my idea of God was a tornado. I was out there in Texas. We were chasing tornadoes. And if you ever seen a big old thunderhead coming up over West Texas, and I guarantee you, and that lightning coming down, buddy, that's power. Now, that's the face I put on God. You can't put that. God's... No. That worked fine for me. It's like Meyer said. You want God to be Mr. Magoo? Go right ahead. It doesn't seem to really matter. We've got a lot of people, guys. We've got Buddhists dying by the thousands out there because they won't come into our fellowship because they think you've got to be a Christian to be here. And you do not. You may get taken to your Christian roots. You may be taken to another, a different faith altogether. How cool is this spiritual journey? And all you've got to do is have an open mind. You think you know what it's supposed to be? You're not going to learn anything. You follow? If you come over here to France with a preconceived idea about what Frenchmen are like and what the countryside's like, No, you come over with an open mind. It's like, oh my gosh, what a beautiful place this is. It's the same thing we have to do with our fellowship, guys. There's a window of opportunity. I've talked about it lots. There's a window of opportunity that takes place. As a result of coming in, learning your truth, and you begin to do the work, this little window opens up. This is a place that I believe Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob clearly understood was the time to work the steps. He uses the word urgently and precisely and willing to go to any lengths. On page 28 in our book, it says, are you willing to, it says, we each in our own turn sought the same escape with the same desperation of drowning men. Y'all understand that? That doesn't mean like we're going to sit down and take our time to do this work. Now, we got guys in meetings killing people, telling people to do that. You can take your time to do this work. Why are we telling people that? Because the book tells us exactly opposite that. The book says, seek the solution with the desperation of a drowning man. You'll follow? But they're right and we're wrong. And we're asked, like the little brother was talking about, not to bring our books in. We don't want to talk about God because we don't want to scare the newcomer off. Listen, if the discussion of God is going to scare the newcomer off, then he's not ready anyway. Somebody comes up and says, well, I'm not sure I believe this God stuff. Then it's perfectly okay. Go drink. Have a nice one on me. Oh, you would send somebody back out to drink? Yes. Because if I force them to do this God thing, they're going to quit before they're halfway through and then blame me for why they couldn't get sober. The book says, talks about attraction, guys. If you're not done, that's the problem that we have in AA. You know the expression, we're picking the little apples too green. Y'all with us? And that's what happens to us in AA. Too many times we spend way too much time working with somebody that's not nearly ready to get sober. Instead of spending it with the people that are desperate to get well, we're out there trying to cajole somebody, trying to egg them on, trying to color it. Don't worry about this God thing right now. Shame on us. Shame on us. Because the one thing that we have to carry to them is this thing called God. We've got these cats coming into treatment, and they see the steps on the wall when they get there. It's a high-dollar treatment center, and they look up the wall and they go, oh, more of this 12-step crap. Yeah, except the difference at this hospital is you're going to get to know what this is really about, not the candy-colored version, but the real McCoy. Lack of power, the book says, where Myers was just reading, lack of power is the dilemma. Y'all follow? Not just around the drinking and drugging, but in the relationships, in my finances, in my health. That's what we're trying to get you guys connected to, is power, real power. I don't need any of that. I just need to stop drinking. Go away. You're not ready. Don't know what to tell you. You don't have to leave, but I don't have time to mess with you. I'm going to go find me somebody that's ready to do this work. Y'all cool with that? And then they work the steps and they have this spiritual experience and it knocks them on their butt. This nonsense that has crept into AA, I'm going to work one step a month until I'm... So you're telling me that you're going to wait a year to have your spiritual experience. Let me ask you a question. What happens if the window of opportunity closes at 2 months? No, and everybody would have a different answer perhaps, but the bottom line, brother, that's it. What happens? I'm 20 years sober. What happens to me if the obsession to drink comes back? I'm going to call my sponsor. No, you're not. If the obsession comes back, you're going to go drink. This is not a self-help program. I'm going to remember the damage I did. I'm going to remember eating out of dumpsters 20 years ago, and I'm going to stop my... No, you're not. You're going to drink. Y'all follow? The window of opportunity is real, folks. And when it closes, it's a bear. That's not the time to go look for a sponsor when your butt's falling off. That's not the time to try to finish doing a fourth step when you want to drink so bad. The time to do that work is when that window is open and you feel comfortable in your skin. Let's don't waste the newcomer's time by just talking willy-nilly. This is the time to get busy. You get what I'm saying is that there's a sense of urgency to finish this work. You follow? How many of us have watched people leave and never come back? The time is now. We've painted this picture in the United States. I don't know about here. In the United States, that you can come back anytime you want. Keep coming back. It works if you work it. That's okay. If you relapse, you can always come back because all we have is today. What a crying shame. We got people out there with 20 years of sobriety relapsing. 20 years down the toilet, coming back in as a newcomer. Most of those people don't ever stay sober again. Y'all understand that? Because of the progression of the illness, they never can come back as a newcomer. But because they thought they had just today, they relapsed. Rubbish. Y'all understand? Some of you are looking confused. I live life one day at a time, folks. I'm telling you. The disease... Where's my beer? I set this down 20 years ago. Did my disease stop progressing? Absolutely not. That's why so many of us, after years of sobriety, start to smoke pot again or start to drink again. The allergy, and then all of a sudden we're gone beyond recall. You know, any of y'all watch somebody come back after a period of sobriety? Oh my gosh, and they're worse shape than ever. How did you get so messed up so quick? Because the disease didn't stop progressing. You thought it went into remission? The effects of it did, but the disease continued to progress. That's why cats with long-term sobriety, I'm hanging on for dear life. Please, don't pay light to this. Don't think that you can walk away from the fellowship and stop going to meetings and stop sponsoring people. Because if you get sick again, you may never make it back. The spiritual experience is real, folks, but you got to do things daily to stay connected. That's what this is about. That's what the rest of what we're talking about this afternoon, that's what that's about. Y'all down with that? This will be fast and furious this afternoon. We'll finish up earlier. There's no way we're going to go to 6 because it's just not that complicated. Cool? We'll see y'all later. Let's go have lunch. Thank you.
Back at 2 o'clock, guys. 2 o'clock in the room.